everyone. This episode is about 3 months overdue. I'm very sorry. Hope you guys still enjoy it. Thank you.
Nothing on this podcast is intended as legal advice, nor does it create an attorney-client relationship. Please be advised that this podcast also contains spoilers and swears.
Welcome to Murder, She Woke, a podcast about sexist cops and the women who do their jobs for them.
I am your host, Elizabeth.
And I'm your other host, Laura.
Laura, you know what we say a lot on this show?
Fuck.
We say that too. But one phrase that we say a lot on this show is, I'm not a criminal lawyer.
Oh, which yes, that.
Caused maybe not so much a headache as it is just wild speculation.
Yeah.
But today is a very special day, and do you know why?
Tell me.
Because we have an actual criminal lawyer on the pod.
Shut
and
up.
And not just any. I would like you to introduce our super very special guest.
Okay, so our super very special guest is none other than our very own fairy pod mother, Katie.
Hi, yes. Guys.
Hi.
Hello, listeners.
Yes, there are. I think we are up to maybe like 10 or 12 now. So hello. And Brian, one star Brian. Got to say
damn it, Brian.
Go fuck yourself, Brian.
That's right. Welcome, Katie. Very special welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Obviously, the most important part of my background is that I am the pod mother.
Yes.
I went to college with Laura.
Yep.
I went to law school with Elizabeth, and I connected them all these years later with their shared love of law and Jessica Fletcher. Mm-hmm. So you're welcome, world, for the Murder, She Woke podcast. You are welcome. I'm also a criminal defense attorney in Georgia. I've been practicing law for about 10 years now.
And that's terrible.
Exclusively in criminal law for the past 8 years. I worked in appeals for about 3 years, and then I've been a trial practicing attorney for the last 5 in felony criminal cases.
In the last 10 years, do you think that you've become jaded or cynical at all?
No, not yet. It might be coming. I'm probably more cynical than I was when I started, but I still care a lot about my job and my client.
And I can actually vouch for this, because when I hang out with Katie, she still believes that her clients tell her the truth. One of them.
Not all of them, and not all the time. I try. So I have an attitude of trust but verify when I can. Most people never give my clients the benefit of the doubt, so when I can, I try to, and sometimes it works out. Sometimes I'm delightfully surprised at how truthful and innocent sometimes my clients are. Sometimes I am devastated and disappointed in them.
Have you ever defended or had cause to be involved with the defense of a murder case? Because we see all kinds of murders on Murder, She Wrote. Imagine that.
I work exclusively right now in felony crimes against people. So aggravated assault, murder, rape, child molestation, all of the crimes, you violent crimes against people.
Law and order SVU crimes.
All the law and order and law and order SVU
and cases. You got to throw the original series in there. Mm-hmm. It's the homicide.
I'm sorry, but if it doesn't have Mariska Hargitay, I just don't want it.
It has Jerry Orbach, okay?
Yes. Not the same. Not
it's
the
not
same.
The same, but it's a different kind of great.
It's something. That's the man that tried to put baby in a corner.
I know, Laura. I know.
Yeah, he was... also Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast, yeah.
Which is the weirdest thing that I learned. That
it's less weird when you know that Angela Lansbury was Mrs. Potts and that she and Jerry Orbach were like besties around that time.
So I knew she was Mrs. Potts, but I need to rewatch the animated Beauty and the Beast so I can listen to Lumiere, because I can't connect those dots.
Mm. Yeah, no, you should. That's your project for when, with your copious amounts of free time, as I'm sure. We are going to be following the pod format with a twist, meaning Katie is going to help us with the recap. And we're also going to be super critical of her whenever she gets details wrong, which is super important.
What I expected.
Ladies, would you like to discuss season one, episode 23, Funeral at 50 Mile?
Let's do it.
Yes.
Yeah. We open on the mountains and we're out west. They appear to be out west mountains. And we find out that we are in 50 Mile, Wyoming, which has a population of 427. And my first question was, since we're going to a funeral in 50 Mile, was this sign changed before or after? Did they change it in anticipation of this guy's death, or is the sign lying to us? That was my first question.
My follow-up question would be, who was the person responsible for the changing of the sign?
My guess would be the coroner.
But the coroner only manages deaths. What about births?
Yeah. What about people moving?
Well, so they've delegated it to two people. The coroner changes it for deaths, and the only doctor in town, changes it for births.
Okay, but what about moving in and out of town? Who does it then?
It could be like the episode of Fringe I saw where they had to keep everybody in this town or else they turn into monsters if they left the town. So the only way to get in or out was to be born or die.
So it's like a one in, one out kind of thing. If somebody dies, they have to go round up as another person and bring them into town.
Oh, no, I mean, meaning they like experimented on these people and they turned them into monsters. And so it was like genetic. So when they had kids, the kids would also be monsters. So nobody would move there because they didn't want to move to Monster Town. And the monsters couldn't leave because they were like stuck being monsters.
That makes sense. That seems the most logical.
Yes. So it's like one of those towns.
Okay. It's a monster town. Got it.
That kind of puts a different twist on the episode though.
Yeah. So they're all monsters.
All monsters.
A monster named Jack Carver is dead. And his daughter, Mary, and a group of older gentlemen who I've nicknamed the boys are there at his funeral. There is Sam Breen, who is played by the amazing William Wyndon, who will go on to play Seth Haslett, but he is not Seth Haslett in this episode. He is the family lawyer, which we find out later. And then we have, what did you name him?
Uncle Eyebrows. Had a very difficult time trying to hide his Irish or Scottish accent.
Oh my God, I literally have that in my notes. And then there's this guy named Bill Carmody. He apparently is some kind of businessman. And then there's this other guy who's the doctor. And they're apparently like all friends from way back and they all seem to know each other. They all have guns and hats. Mary, the daughter, is dressed like she's meeting the Pope. And everybody else at the funeral is wearing a cowboy hat. And at the end of the funeral, while they're folding the flag, they get interrupted by a very large and very loud RV that squeals into the parking lot of the church. And out comes from this RV a couple who I will describe as polyester cowboy and Sandy from the last act of Grease, but she's in Montana and also about 15 years older. So her name is Sally. His name is Carl, and Carl is not welcome at this funeral. And he is told so by Mr. Carmody, who is the business guy. It's hard to keep these white men straight. Bill Carmody yells at Polyester Cowboy to get the fuck out of here. Mary is very confused. There's some exposition. Apparently, her mom died in childbirth, and she was the only child. She was raised by her father, and now Mary, presumably, is alone, except for Art, who is her fiancé, and he's just a basic white guy. So they walk away from the funeral. We cut to the Carver Ranch. Doc is trying to get Jessica drunk on dandelion wine, and Uncle Tim is looking out the window worriedly because he has the ranch next door and he thinks that storm is going to fuck shit up. this is where his Scottish accent slips most noticeably. Like when he turns away from the window, he basically says something to the effect of, storms are coming, I better call over there. And
yeah,
he literally sounds like that summer I spent in Aberdeen. Jess is talking to Doc and she kind of spies a lawman, as it were, in the wake or like the after party. I don't know what they call this specifically. And this guy has seen a few too many Westerns, and Doc kind of advises that this guy is basically, he's a poser. He's watched too many Clint Eastwood movies. He has a gun pointed down in his holster. I don't know what the difference between that and like carrying a gun the normal way is.
Something about how it was secured so he'd like get it out faster.
That makes sense.
But I don't know.
He tells her her books are fine for a woman. And apparently he's never been in any kind of action, but he thinks of himself as like some kind of Clint Eastwood type. So he practices quick drawing on his gun. Anyway, he's ridiculous. So I nicknamed him Dirty Harry. He does use the line later. And yeah, so we can call him whatever, or like 12-year-old sheriff. Harry and Sam, aka Doc Hazlitt, are talking about the will. And Tim, Uncle Dub Eyebrows, kind of confronts them about it. And they decide there's no better time than the funeral after party to talk about who gets what. Uncle Tim says that Jack was going to sell him the ranch after he died. And they had agreed on it. And Mary says, oh, well, this is news to me. And then Sam interjects, but there was no will. And then Sam says, well, Mary will inherit everything because she's the only heir. There's a little bit of tension between Uncle Eyebrows and Mary whenever she says she'll consider his offer for the ranch. And then they just kind of go their separate ways. And then here comes Polyester Cowboy charging into the house with, we need to give her a name. And I need to think it needs to be better than Sandy from the last act of Grease, but in Montana.
Especially since they're in Wyoming.
You're right. But she could have been in Montana.
She could have been. I'm sure she has been in Montana at some point.
Or we could just call her by her name, which is Sally.
We call her Saucy Sally.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's good.
Ooh, that's really good. Yeah. Ooh,
smart. I'm contributing.
Yeah, no, you can be our consultant for nicknames.
Also, I want to point out that so when Uncle Eyebrows is looking out the window, it's storming really bad. But when we see the RV pull up, it's bright outside. It is like daylight. There is not a cloud in the sky. It's not raining. It is bright outside.
They don't get a continuity budget until at least season two. Saucy Sally and Polyester Cowboy come storming in, and it comes to light that Polyester Cowboy had visited Jack Carver, the dead guy, in his hospital right before he died. And Mary says that he probably ruined the last few hours of her father's life and get the fuck out of my house. And he turns it around on her and says, this isn't your house, bitch. I have a will. And according to this will, Polyester Cowboy gets the ranch and his daughter gets a little bit of money and everybody is SOL and Art is mad and he tries to beat him up. So the boys have to break it up. Jess, in the meantime, kind of approaches Polyester Cowboy and kind of shakes him down a little bit for some info. She wants to know why Jack Carver would disinherit his only daughter, because back in Maine, people just don't do that. I guess it's different out here in the big city. And he claims that he saved Jack life in Korea, and then Jess tries to trip him up by asking him about her husband Tom Fletcher, which any Fletcherite will know is not Jessica's late husband's name. So he claims to know this Fletcher guy. He talks about how great he is, and Jess just kind of nods and rolls her eyes. Mary was so overcome with lady feelings that the doctor had to like give her a tranquilizer. Art is still cheese, but he's going out to get his pickup from somewhere. And he says he'll be back. All the boys and Polyester Cowboy are going out to the barn. The next scene we get is everybody, I thought it was the next day at breakfast, but apparently they're eating soup, so it's dinner. And we meet Emma, who is presumably the cook/housekeeper. And later we meet Jesus, who I guess is like a ranch hand. Art is late for dinner. He says he got stuck in the mud and he apparently abandoned his truck and he got back somehow, but he's been absent for a little while. All of a sudden, Jesus runs out to the barn, starts screaming, and then they all go to the barn and Polyester Cowboy is hanged in the barn. Oh no.
Everyone's out in the barn and then the sheriff shows up and this is his first homicide investigation. He's clearly out of his league. I'm not sure he's ever had to solve any crime before at all. After they get Polyester Cowboy down, Jess overhears the sheriff say to himself, "How'd he do it?" And Jessica pipes up and says, "You're absolutely right. He didn't have anything to stand on or jump off of. So it can't be suicide. It has to be murder." And he just kind of nods his head, yes. And then she mentions that the killer pulled bales of hay closer to the body, probably to suggest suicide. And you kind of see the sheriff nodding his head. And then Jessica points out a blood smear that it's behind the left ear of the dead guy, suggesting he was hit by a blunt object before being hung. And then she also points out that there are freshly splintered wood particles on the beam where the rope is, and that suggests that the beam was supporting the dead guy's weight when he was thrown over the beam. And then the doc says he's been dead 4 or 5 hours. And then the sheriff chimes in that puts the death around 3 p.m. And he is very proud of this deduction that he's made of simple math. All of this kind of logical reasoning was done by Jessica. But then, of course, sheriff has to take credit for it. And then later that night, Jessica and Mary are talking on the porch. And Jessica asks her about the dead guy showing up at the hospital and what she meant about it shortening her father's life. And Mary said that she was there for her daily visit and she saw the dead guy coming out of his room. He wasn't dead at that time, but I'm just going to call him the dead guy, coming out of her father's hospital room, looking all smug. And her father was so upset, he couldn't talk afterwards and he wasn't ever the same. And then he died 2 days later. And then that makes Jess theorize that since the witness signatures on the will were by the hospital nurses, the dead guy probably showed up at the hospital with the will already drafted and then somehow pressured her father into signing the will. And Jessica also mentions that the bullshit that he said about saving Jack's life during the war was bullshit because she tripped him up on knowing her husband, Frank. Bill comes out to the porch to round them up for the sheriff. And we learn that he was involved with a bad business deal with a dead guy that left him broke. So everyone goes inside and there's a bunch of people sitting around the table. And then Saucy Sally comes in and starts arguing with Mary, which distracts the sheriff. When he's able to kind of refocus everyone, he says, "All right, now where were we?" And then Jess again uses this to kind of plant an idea into his head and says, "You're right. Where were we? That's the question you were going to ask. Where were we all at 3 p.m.? And so everyone is kind of giving their alibis at this point. So Uncle Eyebrows and Bill were moving horses into the stable. The lawyer was moving feed into the barn to keep it dry. Uncle Eyebrows and Bill can confirm they saw him there. And then Doc was on the other side of the compound closing up the garage. So all four of the boys can alibi each other. At this point, the Doc comes into the house and says, "So actually it was the blow on the back of the head that killed the dead guy. That was instantly fatal. He must have been hung afterwards." And then Saucy Sally says, "Well, that's sick to hang a dead man." And then Uncle Eyebrows interjects and says, "Well, in the old days, ranchers would hang dead wolves and coyotes to scare off thieving varmints," which was a little scary.
Yeah, it's not a nice image. In my hometown, they had this issue where vultures would hang out on the water tower, which had the name of our hometown painted across it in enormous letters. And so it was like sort of a looked like a bad omen for the town.
Were they turkey vultures or redheaded vultures?
I think turkey vulture. What they would do is someone would go out and kill a vulture and hang it from one of the lower parts of the water tower. Mm-hmm. So it would scare the other vultures away.
Did that work?
So, I don't know. It was vultures very creepy. Eat
each other.
Right. They eat carrion. So I don't.
Yeah. Like, I don't know that vultures would be too picky when push comes to shove.
They would just be like, oh, fast food.
Right. And they just hung it here very conveniently at my flapping level for me to eat.
Can we go back for 1 second? Because I forgot to mention something is that Sea Sally, before Polyester Cowboy ends up dead, she gets into a very public and very obnoxious arm wrestling match with him, whereby she kicks his ass. So I forgot to add that. This becomes relevant. Yeah,
That is relevant. And I thought it was weird that like they bet like $500. She's like, okay, $500, I can kick your ass. And then he actually pays her.
Well, he only pays her $450.
Well, yes. She
comes running after him, asking for the rest of her money, which I thought indicated some things that turned out to be true later.
Right, right. So, but I just thought between a married couple, who knows how they have their finances, but it was weird that he took cash out of his wallet to put in her wallet. Exactly.
I think it's a clue.
Yeah. We're back to the alibis for the women. And oddly enough, every single woman was sleeping. So Mary
That's
was
what
sleeping.
Women do.
Except for Emma. She was cleaning up.
Right. Yeah. Women are sad and sleepy. That's all they're good for.
It was funny because there were like three different kinds of sleep. It was like sleeping pill sleep, jet lag sleep, and like hangover sleep.
Right. No, like they had to qualify what kind of sleeping it was. So Mary was sleeping off the sleeping pills that the doc gave her. And then Saucy Sally was sleeping off her hangover in the RV. And then Jess was napping off of her jet lag. And the sheriff concludes, well, you know, it doesn't really matter that no one can alibi the women because they're not strong enough to have hung the dead guy. And also Art Merrick, Mary's fiance, is the only one who doesn't have an alibi. So therefore he must be the killer.
It's called process of elimination.
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 So the next scene is Art and Jesus getting Art's truck unstuck out of the mud. So the sheriff pulls up with Jess and Mary following and then walks up to Art and goes on about this extravagant plan on how Art left the ranch after the fight. But he drove just far enough away not to be seen. And then he came back on foot and he killed the dead guy. And then he drove off in the truck and then got the truck stuck on purpose to have an alibi. The next morning, Jess and Mary go to the jail. As they come in, the lawyer and the sheriff are arguing over the arrest. And Jess implores sheriff to use logic. And this kind of actually kind of got under the sheriff's skin a little bit. He's like, well, what do you mean by that? And Jessica explains that the dead guy was struck on the left side of his head, the back of his head, indicating a left-handed killer, but Art is right-handed. Also, Art has no motive because with the dead guy being dead, now his wife inherits the farm. So she's really the only one with motive. And the sheriff gets flustered and storms out because he's getting bullied in his own jail. And then the lawyer leaves to go do some other lawyer stuff. And Art is still in the jail cell. Jail cell. And he shares what he overheard in a telephone conversation between the sheriff and the coroner. And the coroner is telling the sheriff that it was absolutely the hanging that killed the dead guy. And then the blow to the head occurred afterwards. So Jessica finds this odd and goes right to the doc's office to ask why he was so sure that the dead guy was hit first. But the doc's out. So she talks to Alice, the receptionist, who is not only the receptionist, but she's also the local telephone operator. So she knows everything about everyone. Jessica explains that she just wants to know about any notes that the doc may have taken about an examination the previous night and asked if maybe she could look through the file. And the receptionist says, oh no, the only time I've ever seen the doc lose his temper is when he caught someone snooping through his files. And he pretty much basically threatened to kill that man if he ever disclosed what he found out that was in the file. And it turns out that man is the dead guy.
Jess apparently leaves Doc's office and we see her and Mary pulling back up at the ranch. As they get out of the car, they're walking
quick,
to the house.
Quick side note. Did you notice that Mary has a Barbie Jeep?
No.
Didn't Barbie know it was a Barbie Jeep.
It's like a lavender, like purple.
Oh, I thought it was light blue.
No, it was purple on my screen. Like, she definitely had a Barbie Jeep. I just thought that was really funny. It's like, oh, it's cute.
That's excellent.
But it's like that time my friend's dad painted her first gun pink, and it was so nice.
No. Oh, yeah. Nothing says back the fuck off, motherfucker, like a pink gun.
Yeah, I mean, she was only 8, so.
Oh. Nothing says I'm not really a gun to an 8-year-old, like a pink gun.
Nothing says back the fuck up like an 8-year-old with a gun.
Yeah, pretty much.
Jess and Mary walk in the house and they've clearly been talking about Doc, and Mary says he's the nicest, gentlest guy ever. And then they meet Emma, the housekeeper, as soon as they walk in the door, and Emma is carrying a tray of tomato juice or Bloody Marys.
Tomato juice.
I'm from Georgia. We say maters. Mater juice and coffee and something. And says that it's for Saucy Sally, who has a hangover and has been in the other room using the phone all day. And don't you know, your phone bill is probably going to be astronomical because she's been making bunches of long distance calls. Mary starts arguing with Saucy Sally, saying, you're on my nerves and you're in my hair and you need to get out of my house. And Sally says, maybe you should move out because this house is basically mine already. And at that point, Mary asks her, what did the dead guy have over my father? And Sally said, basically concedes that there was blackmail, but she doesn't know what he was being blackmailed for. So we cut to the next scene, and it's Art Merrick coming home. The sheriff is bringing him home, saying that they've dropped the murder charges, and all the boys seem to be there as well. And so Jess is thanking the sheriff for doing the right thing. It's hard to admit when you're wrong. And so she praises him for admitting he was wrong, which is, you know, actually
crazy. He's not the one that like drops the murder charges though, right? Like,
but he says I dropped the murder charges. I don't know who the prosecutor in this town is.
It sounds like he is. I think he might be judge, jury, and executioner.
He might be.
That's a lot of people out of 457.
Yeah. 27. Yeah. That's half the town is involved in the criminal justice system just by default. Jess and the marshal have this conversation. I called him the marshal because that's what Jess called him. But so the sheriff, Dirty Harry guy. And so, but he says that Art is still his number one suspect because he doesn't have a better one. And so Jess says, I think maybe you should challenge Saucy Sally to an arm wrestling competition. And so cut to they're inside and the sheriff is challenging Saucy Sally to arm wrestle. And of course she stomped because she is apparently very strong. And during the course of this, that we get this lovely zoom in shot because before she arm wrestles, she takes off all her jewelry. And she did that in the first arm wrestling scene too. And we get this camera zoom in to her arm where she has taken off a bracelet and there's a tan line. And so it comes out after the arm wrestling competition that she is left-handed. And of course, we know that whoever hit the dead guy to kill him earlier was left-handed. And she's very strong, which the sheriff had previously thought no woman could have committed the crime because they weren't strong enough. And so he says in front of Saucy Sally, well, I guess you're right. A left-handed woman could have committed this crime. And so Sally is very angry that she has been tricked into incriminating herself in a crime and tells them to both go suck eggs, which is my new favorite, I guess. You guys can go suck eggs.
Suck eggs.
Suck eggs. So cut to The next scene seems to be the middle of the night. Jess is in the bed. She hears a noise. And so she gets up out of the bed and looks out the window. And there is a noose hanging there outside of her window, which is very scary for any normal person. But Jess Fletcher is like, I must be making somebody nervous. And she is very satisfied with herself, which is great. It's a great scene. The next morning, for some reason, all the boys and Mary and Jess and Art are all having breakfast together. And all the boys are there. They don't have their own home. Well,
the boys had mentioned, I think earlier, or I think it was Sam had told Jessica that he and the boys were going to stick around just until this was settled. You know,
Mary, I remember
she's
that.
A little lady, she can't take care of herself now.
No. And by the way, we'll just count on Emma to make everybody breakfast.
Right.
And feed them. Like, she doesn't already have enough work to do.
Yeah. But you can tell that Sally's the mean one because he calls her a kind of racially insensitive name.
Oh yeah, this is a real intense breakfast. So Sally walks in straight up throwing herself at Art right in front of Mary and being entirely too racist for breakfast. you just cannot deal with that level of crampiness and racism at breakfast. It's too early. No one's had their second cup of coffee yet. It's a lot. Yeah, she calls Emma Chiquita. It was very uncomfortable. Emma doing a great job keeping it together.
Mary, on the other hand, was not doing such a great job at keeping it together.
Yeah, no, she was going to jump up and do something about it.
Yeah.
Not the racist part. Just the part where she was loving on her man.
Spilled a pot of coffee down saucy Sally's lap, and now she'll be soggy Sally.
Oh!
Also, can I just note something that was a little bit racist that wasn't in the show, but was in the credits? They have Jesus, presumably spelled J-E-S-U-S.
Jesus, yeah.
They had it spelled H-A-Y-S-O-O-S in the credits. So,
really? Why? Yes.
Because I don't know if they counted on people not knowing that Jesus and what appears to be Jesus spelled out is the same name. I'm going to go back and check that, but I'm pretty sure it said Jesus as in phonetical spelling of Jesus.
Well, in the closed caption, it was the phonetical spelling of it was the actual real spelling of Jesus, like Jesus.
I'll let y'all know. That so you guys ridiculous. Are going to have to wait until we come back for season two to find out, or you can watch the episode yourselves.
So in the middle of weird sexual racist breakfast, the sheriff shows up with an arrest warrant for Sally. So there must be some judge in town signing warrants. I'm just a magistrate though, I'm sure. So he shows up with a warrant for Sally and she is angry. And I can't remember what she said, but she made a terroristic threat. So she made some threat of violence against the sheriff for coming there too.
And it wasn't conditioned. It wasn't a conditional threat.
She said she was going to do something to him. At that point, she's very angry and upset. And then Jess tells her, come on, you don't have to get arrested. You can just come clean about the fact that you and the dead guy are not actually married. So you do not have a motive for this crime. It does come out. And she says that Jess had noticed that she didn't have a tan line on her ring finger the way she did for her bracelet. And somehow in all of that, Sally lets them know that whatever the blackmail was, it had to do with all of the boys, with Uncle Eyebrows and Doc and Sam and Bill, all of the most generic names, other than Uncle Eyebrows, all the most generic man names.
He was Tim.
They were all very, very generic.
Not like Jesus names. Over here with his strange foreign name.
Jesus. I forgot to mention, so in addition to the lack of tan line, Jess had also gotten the phone records, I guess, by calling the gossipy lady at the doctor's office and got the phone records.
50 Mile Letitia.
Yeah. So she had gotten the phone records and deduced that Saucy Sally had been calling, trying to get someone to fake a marriage license for her so that she would be able to inherit the ranch from dead Carl. And now we know that the blackmail involves all of the boys and not just Bill and Jack. This is the thing. And this seems to come up in a lot of episodes of Murder, She Wrote, and therefore more Murder, She Woke, the marshal tells Sally not to leave town. That is not a thing. You can't tell people not to leave town.
You just confirmed it, and you are.
So if someone is arrested and they're given a bond, the judge can set conditions on their bond that can include don't leave the jurisdiction or don't leave the city limits, whatever. But she's not been arrested, and no judge has given her an order.
He does have an arrest warrant.
But she hasn't been in front of a judge for a bond.
That's true.
I've never seen a situation where the judge signs a warrant and the bond condition. I guess if the sheriff is the one who requested the warrant, he can change his mind and not affect the arrest. He's got that discretion. But he doesn't have the authority to tell her not to leave town. Sheriff tells her not to leave town, which he can't do. And then I guess it's either this scene or the next scene where anyway, Jess says, well, I have an idea that the killer is a tall, strong, ambidextrous man. But she doesn't, I don't think she explains at that moment how she comes to that conclusion. We then are out on the porch and the RV is pulling off and nobody is sad to see Saucy Sally leaving in the RV. And I would just point out that Jess is wearing a dress with boots and it's cute. And
did you see her like literal blanket that she was wearing as a scarf in the earlier scenes?
A literal blanket scarf.
A literal blanket worn as like one you get at those like Southwestern gift shops, but like kind of like drapes around her. It looked very cozy.
At that point, Jess and Mary and Art are all on the porch. Jess is wearing the skirt and boot or the dress and boot combo or skirt and boot combo. And then Mary and Art decide that now it's time, now that he's out of jail and Saucy Sally is gone, it's time to go get his pickup truck that he was arrested while trying to recover from the mud the night before. So I guess Jess heads back in the house and Doc is sitting at the dining room table peeling an apple. And she says, "You're left-handed." And he says, "Yes, I am left-handed." And he starts asking her about why she thinks the killer must be ambidextrous. And she explains, well, the dead guy was hit by a left-handed person, but whoever hung the noose outside of my window was right-handed, or whoever tied that knot was right-handed, because Jess is a noose tying expert and knows whether it was tied by a
writer. She writes murder mystery. She knows how to kill people and get away with it.
And boats, probably. I think she used a lot of knots with boats. At that point, Jess also tells Doc, oh, by the way, you were wrong when you said that the blow to the back of the head is what killed him, because the coroner is convinced that he died from the hanging and was hit after the fact.
Okay, so pause it there. Mm-hmm. And this is just coming to me. So Doc is the only doctor in town. Coroner is probably elected, which they are in most rural areas. I don't know if that's true about urban areas. So chances are the coroner is not a doctor. How does the coroner have knowledge and experience to say how the dead guy died that is different than the actual doctor?
Also, isn't there blood like from the guy's head? Theoretically, like if the guy were dead, there wouldn't be that much blood. That's what we learned in the bus episode.
Well, I mean, the things happened very close in time. I don't know how much that would. So I don't know about that. But I do know that coroners are an elected office. They are often not people who have any particular medical training. In fact, coroners are often funeral directors because they're the only person in town who owns a hearse. And I could probably rant.
So hold on. So you could buy a hearse and then maybe run for coroner and then get it because you have a hearse?
I would love to spend the next 90 minutes talking to you about the broken, historical, terrible death investigation system in this country, largely having to do with coroners and how they don't, many of them, not all of them, but many of them don't know how to conduct death investigations, and that the coroner's inquest system, which came up earlier this season,
like the first episode, I think,
was used to cover up racially motivated lynchings, right-handed noose, The coroner says he was hanged before he was hit in the head. And then I have a note here to maybe discuss the coroner system, which we covered. So Jess is like, well, I'm just going to go take a walk, maybe look around the barn, see if I can find any clues, I guess. And so Doc follows her out there and he's trying to convince her to drop it and to stop looking into this. You're only going to get someone hurt. And so Jess says the only person who's going to be, I mean, she basically says the person you're trying to protect from being hurt is Mary, and that Carl was killed to protect Mary in some way, shape, or form. So they go out to the barn, and it turns out all the rest of the boys are already in the barn waiting. And I called it the accusing barn.
I
do listen to the barn too.
To the accusing barn.
Hooray. So in the accusing barn, so it's all of the boys. It's Tim, Uncle Eyebrows, Doc, Sam. Sam is the lawyer, and then Bill is the business guy. So earlier, before, when Jess is out on the porch and Mary and Art are leaving, she is wearing the boots. When she walks into the barn, she is wearing her normal pumps, just so you know. I caught that.
I had a continuity issue when the sheriff was in the jail and Jessica and the lawyer were kind of ganging up on him. And one scene, in one cut, he throws down a file in frustration. But when the camera pans over to him in the next cut, he's holding the file again.
No,
maybe he picked it up. Maybe he felt ashamed of throwing it on the floor.
No, they didn't.
Jess comes into the barn and she's like, hey guys, why don't you just finally tell me what happened, I guess. And then the story all comes out now that all the boys are here in one place and Mary is not around. I did not make a note of who was doing most of the talking, but I think it was Uncle Eyebrows started telling the story about what happened. And the first thing he tells us is that Carl, the dead guy, his real name is Randy. And Randy is a rapist. And that feels a little bit on the nose. Mm-hmm. So
I thought Randy was a descriptor because they called him a Randy Ranch Hand.
Oh, I thought he was saying he was not, his name was not Carl.
Pretty sure Randy was a descriptor. I didn't write down his real name. But
I called him a Randy Ranch Hand.
Okay. To me, using the word Randy is so much more cringe than using the word horny.
Yeah, it is. I think there was another comment later on about how he was using a fake name.
Yeah.
So I think his name was Randy. I think he was Randy the Ranch Hand.
Could be.
I'll just look it up while you guys are talking. It's fine.
Well, we'll continue to call him Carl because he's dead and that's the name he died with. So turns out that Carl had been a ranch hand and had been infatuated with Ruth, who was Mary's mother and Jack's wife, and she had spurned his advances. And one day he just decided he didn't care and raped her, and she became pregnant with Mary. At that point, the boys, including Jack, who is the person who died at the beginning of the episode, whose funeral we were at, attempted to lynch Carl then. And then Jack said, no, I don't want to kill him. We'll just make him turn himself in, or we'll take him to the law. But Carl gets away and is never brought to justice. Ruth was in a very fragile mental state at that time and then died during childbirth, giving birth to Mary. Jack did not want Mary to know who her actual biological father was and raised her as his own and obviously loved her very much. And so it turned out that when Carl had been snooping around files at the doctor's office, what he had discovered was that Jack, Mary's purported father, was sterile. So he could not have been her father.
Did you say
father.
Sterile?
I did.
She sure did.
I did. Sterile.
For leaving that in.
So anyway, he was sterile. So he could not have been Mary's father. So I guess this was the proof he needed, that Carl needed for the blackmail. So presumably he came to the hospital, blackmailed Jack with that, and that's how he got him to sign the will. So the day that Carl died, the boys had seen Carl go into the barn, and then they saw the horse run into the barn, which I suppose was reminiscent of their previous attempted lynching him. And so they go in the barn, put Carl on the horse, and put the noose around his neck. And I have, quote, we told ourselves we only wanted to scare him, but they did have a rope around his neck. And then the lightning, so lightning strikes, the horse gets scared and bolts, leaving him behind, hanging from the noose, and his neck is snapped. Doc says that he knows it won't look like a suicide because of where he is. So they take him down, hit him over the back of the head, and put him back up, which I didn't fully understand.
Right. So how does that look more of a like more of a suicide?
Well, I guess it doesn't look like a suicide, but it confuses the homicide investigation. I mean,
the guy wasn't playing with a full deck, like Dirty Harry over here. Right. It didn't take a whole lot to confuse him.
If Jessica Fletcher had not been there, he never would have gotten.
Yeah, well, I mean, then Rhinestone Saucy Sally would be in the clink or
Art, I guess.
Art. Maybe he just like arrest everybody and kill them all and let God sort it out type of thing.
At that point, Jess is like, well, what are you going to do now? Are you going to kill me to keep this secret from Mary? And the boys all say, apparently they're not going to kill Jess, but that seems to be something that at least was contemplated by her, if not by them. They say, basically, well, we'll confess to what happened. We'll go to trial. We'll let a jury decide if we're guilty or not, but we're all going to take the secret of Mary's parentage to our grave. And Jess also agrees to keep that secret. And then she walks out of the barn, arm in arm, with one of the lynchers. And that's how it ends. Mm. The
good
end.
Story. Mm-hmm. Good
story. Petey, as super special guest and more criminal law expert than either of us will ever be, we would like to know what stood out the most to you in terms of issues, as it were.
Well, I'm going to start with what's always an issue in Murder, She Wrote. And that is, as you often bring up, the chain of custody issue, but also the question of all of these interrogations that Jess is conducting. She's often the only person to hear these confessions. And she must be very busy flying back and forth across the country all year to testify in all of these trials that she is oftentimes the most important witness in. So that is one issue, but we can also just talk about the charges. So
let's hear your thoughts. What could they be charged with? What would they likely be charged with? Possible defenses?
Mm-hmm. My first thoughts, and I haven't really come up with a lot in addition to this, but the most obvious thing that they could be charged with, I think, is felony murder. Georgia does not really have degrees of murder the way you hear about in shows like Law and Order. We have malice murder, we have felony murder, and we have manslaughter. So felony murder is a not necessarily an intentional death, but a death that results when a person is engaged in the commission of a felony offense. So in this case, to charge felony murder, you would have to allege that there was an underlying felony that did cause the death, even if it was not intentional. And so we had some conversation about this before. If they forced him onto the horse, we probably have a kidnapping or false imprisonment situation, which can be the underlying charge for a felony murder. But even if they didn't intend him to die, they put him in the dangerous position by their own felonious actions.
Are there misdemeanor charges of kidnapping and false imprisonment as well?
Not really. So a sort of a catch-all misdemeanor would be a sort of reckless conduct type charge, which is where you do something that's not necessarily criminal in and of itself, but you've done something that is very reckless or negligent, so much so that you should be held responsible for whatever the outcome of that is. And so if you have an argument here that by putting the noose around his neck in the way that they did, that they had engaged in reckless conduct while he was on the back of the horse. I mean, ordinarily just touching someone with your hands, putting your hands on someone in a way that's not actually causing an injury. So the act of putting a rope around someone's neck, that is a misdemeanor assault or battery type situation. That's not going to be a felony unless you're talking about potential hate crime situations. It's a lynching. It's something around his neck. There are arguments to be made that that's a deadly weapon. But say I just touched your neck with my hand, that's typically just going to be a misdemeanor. So you've got that sort of argument about it, or potentially the reckless conduct. If the underlying crime for the homicide case is a misdemeanor, then you're talking about an involuntary manslaughter. And what that means is that you did not intentionally cause this person to die, but you engaged in some very reckless or misdemeanor type criminal conduct that caused the death. And so you are going to be found to be culpable for it. But of course, that's not going to be as serious as a murder charge. I can't think off the top of my head what the maximum sentence in Georgia is for involuntary manslaughter, but it's probably 10 years because voluntary manslaughter is 20. So those seem the two most obvious things to charge these guys with would be either the felony murder or an involuntary manslaughter.
So when we look at the flashback of the dead guy on the horse, no one's holding a gun to his head to keep him on the horse, right? So he seems like if he wanted to, he could simply jump off the horse. So what about an argument that he voluntarily got on the horse? Maybe he didn't actually voluntarily jump on the horse, but he didn't struggle or put up a fight, or he didn't jump off the horse when he could have.
Well, at some point he had a rope around his neck, so jumping off the horse would not have been wise. But you don't have to have a gun to your head to be kidnapped. And any threat of physical violence, I mean, he's surrounded by four other people. He's one guy unarmed around four other people. Mm-hmm. So you imagine a situation where you were just one person standing in your way, physically intimidating, keeping you in a room. That could be a false imprisonment.
Now, is that though more subjective or objective? Because if you look at the flashback, he's laughing, he's joking. He doesn't feel or think that they're serious. Mm-hmm. He doesn't appear to feel threatened or look threatened at all. Does that come into play at all?
It would come into play with the question of, was he in prison? So yeah, mm-hmm. I don't think the code section or there's any case law that says a person must feel imprisoned. Mm-hmm. The question is whether or not they were. So mm-hmm. I would say that would be a jury question.
So felony murder, we talked about felony murder was, and then you mentioned maybe involuntary manslaughter. Anything else?
I mean, and then there's all the underlying charges. Yeah. I mean, if you're charged with felony murder and the predicate for that is a false imprisonment, you can also be charged with a false imprisonment, but those will merge for sentencing mm-hmm. purposes. And so they could charge him with a battery for every person who put their hands on him without consent. They could charge the false imprisonment or the kidnapping.
This is the second fucking
time.
He had a rape / death in childbirth. And just brought up like,
right. Just casually. Yeah,
as a subplot.
Yeah. I wouldn't even call it a subplot.
Just mentioned in passing and just was like, yeah,
that happened.
Just yeah. Randy Raper, just raping people.
What happens when she finds out, like, shit like that doesn't stay hidden. What happens when she finds out and suddenly she's pissed off at you because you didn't tell her?
Yeah.
Also, the doc could have destroyed her father's records that said he was sterile. So then there's no proof, but I guess that's kind of beside the point.
But here's the thing. It's like, just because she is sterile or he is sterile doesn't automatically make her Randy rapist's kid. Like she could have been a sperm donor. There could be like any other, there could be a thousand.
Her mother could have had a consensual affair
they could have had an open relationship.
How do I put this? He would have to like incriminate himself, even though I'm sure it's like well past the statute of limitations. Incriminate himself for what? Like there's no real winning for him. Like even if he's blackmailing,
what is he gonna do? Is he gonna say, if you don't sign this will, I'm gonna tell everyone that I raped your wife, and then your daughter, my daughter, was a product of that?
Yeah, that's,
he didn't think through that. Who's blackmailing
who here? Why didn't they have a will? He has like a family attorney who's like his buddy. Laura, you're the will person in here. Why didn't he have a will?
His will was too strong to just not make one.
Well, sometimes, and Laura, you can tell me if this is completely stupid of me. If I die, I just assume everything go to my husband.
Yes.
And so I don't need a will for that.
Right.
And so he wanted everything to go to his daughter. Granted, he knew that it wasn't his legitimate daughter. So maybe you should have thought about that. But why does he need a will if everything he wants everything to go to her?
A will would speed things up in probate court because you don't have to go through the process of like possibly notifying potential heirs. But I mean, we're talking
about she just wants me to pay her to make me a will.
But yeah. Oh, but well, he's got a brother, but the brother shouldn't inherit. Mm-mm. But the brother, I guess, could maybe make a claim. I don't know.
Seems like the brother could be like, oh, like, Mary's not the heir. I am, because that's not his daughter.
Yeah, but then
he would be the one who could contest the will.
Yeah, presumed parent. No, but enough about family law, but like presumed parented. The child is presumed to be the child of the mother's husband if it was born during wedlock or that kind of thing. And he never disclaimed her or anything.
A question I have is, after these dudes confess to Jessica, what duty does Jessica have to bring that information forward?
None. So there have been states, I think, historically, that have tried to pass what are called Good Samaritan laws that require individuals with information about criminal cases, witness crimes, to come forward and provide that information. But I think they have all consistently been struck down by the Supreme Court. And I can't remember off the top of my head if that has to do with First Amendment
I
issues.
I would think
it has
First Amendment.
Privacy issues. Yeah. Of you are not required to volunteer almost anything to law enforcement under any circumstances. Now, what you cannot do is make a false statement. You cannot conceal and you cannot make a false statement. You can refuse to answer questions, but you can't lie. So if, and so that's another issue with Jessica. If these gentlemen go to trial, she had been so integral in the discovery and their confessions and everything that happened. There's no way those men go to trial and Jess is not on the witness list. She's got to be. Except for that cop is probably going to take credit for everything she did. So maybe not, but she's got to be on the witness list and she's going to be under oath and she can't refuse to answer questions under oath and she can't lie. So I don't know what happens when they put Jess on the stand and they ask her about what they said in the barn. I mean, she's going to lie or she's going to refuse to answer those questions, be held in contempt.
She's not going to lie. We know Jessica.
Exactly.
So, I mean, lie. Really? Okay. So in my opinion, the best thing Jessica could do was keep her mouth shut, because I am not a fan of vengeance and vigilante justice at all, but I'm not sad about this one.
He's not a very sympathetic victim. No.
No.
Did you guys like this episode?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. The characters were interesting. The killers were interesting. The crime was interesting. Yeah, I liked it. I give it 7.5 ashtrays.
Wow. That was even better than last time's, which was 7 ashtrays. And I can't remember why.
Maybe I didn't like it that much. Maybe
it's no, you did like it. No, okay. Was the one because you liked it because of the office reunion that we had in the last one. Is this really better than an office reunion?
Is it better?
It's okay.
No, it's not.
See, I talked Laura into being mean.
6.5 ashtrays.
What about you, Katie?
7. Okay, 6.5.
So I liked this episode. I thought it was fun. There were horses. There were cowboy boots and dresses. There was a pretty good whodunit kind of mystery situation going on.
I thought that it was creative the way that it ended. And I also think they're getting a little bit better with their subtle clues than they are. Cause I know like in earlier episodes, it was kind of like being bashed over the head. And now it's kind of like just being hit on the head gently. So I think it's a sign of good things to come. Plus I love Seth Hazlitt, even when he's not Seth Hazlitt. I'm going to give it 7.5.
Oh, yes. Wow. So you thought it was better than last episode?
Well, I'm not an office stan like you.
But I just thought the episode was just okay. It's your rating. You can have
listen,
it.
There's a Barbie Jeep and a blanket worn as a cape and
all good points.
A lady
tomato juice.
A woman who wore culottes to her own father's funeral. Like take some balls. Laura,
Yeah.
And Katie, did you find yourselves Golden Gradys?
Yeah. I mean, I think I have to go with the obvious, very obvious sheriff on this one. He definitely just failed into this position. His dad's probably the judge. He has no business being the sheriff. He has no business really doing anything, kind of like Brady.
Am I allowed to pick the same one that Laura picked? Okay, because also that, and kind of for all of those reasons, he was just sort of, I mean, he definitely looked the part of the sheriff or the marshal, as he wanted to be called. But
yes, he wanted to be called marshal, but he's a sheriff.
Those are two different things,
right? And I would think that sheriff would be better than a marshal. Doesn't a marshal just drive prisoners around?
Yeah, federal marshals, sometimes fugitive task force type things, can be cool to be a marshal. Okay. I think one of Jeremy's aunts was a federal marshal, and she was like a sharpshooter or something. Cool. But the sheriff is an elected office with a lot more authority, but I don't know. But yeah, he seemed to be the person who was the most failing up in the episode. I guess everyone else, all the other men in the episode were murderers. So
except for Art, you just kind of forgot about him. But I have to agree. And we have a trifecta on Golden Gradys. Nice.
Have you guys ever agreed on the Golden Grady
before?
We
agreed, but for different reasons, yeah. I think before, but I think this is the first time where we're all kind of like on the same path.
Yeah.
Trifecta. Yeah.
And Art seemed like a genuinely nice guy, and he seemed very capable as the foreman or whatever of this massive ranch, so he didn't strike me as a Grady.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a moment or two when I thought he might be, but then I was like, no, too smart. Very super special extra thanks to Podmother Katie for being here with us today. Do you have anything you would like to tell our listeners before you sign off?
Well, thank you very much, Laura and Elizabeth, for having me and for creating this beautiful podcast that would not exist without me. And you're welcome again. And I've had a lot of fun, and try to make me sound smart when you edit the episode.
I mean, there's only so much editing we can do.
I was going to say, I'm not a miracle worker.
I know. I understand.
Only Jesus can do. Only Jesus can do miracles.
Jesus!
Next time on the pod will be season 2, episode 1, to be determined, because I have to move and then go to Europe, and Laura has to play more golf.
And tennis.
So thanks out there to everybody who has been with us for this whole fucking season, or for just a couple episodes.
Except for you, Brian. Fuck you.
Yeah, fuck you, Brian. Enemy of the pod, Brian.
To you two for finishing a whole season of this show. You have done an excellent job, and I have really enjoyed listening to it happen.
Thank you.
So everybody should rate, review, and subscribe. And remember,
stay woke. In unison.